Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm Ron Edwards, and this is the Don and Ron program. Wednesday night, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. A couple of interesting events going on, both domestically and internationally. I'll be joined in a short period of time by my co-host, Mr. Don Allen, who is en route to studio. We should be expecting to hear from him at a fairly reasonable time. But we will start this program by taking a look at some very revealing and frightening information that is coming out of the Middle East, where a investigation has intensified with regards to the crash of a Russian passenger airline a couple of days ago in the Sinai. The Sinai, a part of Egypt that borders Israel and the Gaza Strip, if you will, for those of you that are looking at your maps. An aircraft that, Airbus, by the way, French-made Airbus. A number of countries are all involved. First of all, the passengers were Russian. The flight was on its way from a resort city in the south of Egypt, if you will, in the Sinai, to St. Petersburg in Mother Russia, if you will, when it disintegrated. That was the initial reports. We immediately were suspicious as a journalist, and having some knowledge and understanding of air fatalities and et cetera, found it extremely difficult to believe that a modern aircraft would disintegrate at 31,000 to 33,000. Mid-air air disasters are rare, though they do happen, but most aircraft crashes take place either on approach / landing or on takeoff, if you will. We had reason to believe as a journalist that there was the possibility of a terrorist act. We certainly did not buy into the initial statements by American so-called experts that there was the possibility, but it was impossible, that the terrorists in the Sinai, including ISIL, would have the capabilities to fire a ground-to-air missile 31,000 feet into the air and hitting the aircraft. Then there began to be discussions about 36 hours to 48 hours after the crash that there was the possibility of a bomb. But many American commentators and others indicated they doubted that. The Russians, though, were extremely quiet. The Egyptians, of course, are in a posture of denial, maintaining that there is no terroristic acts going on inside of Egypt, though the Sinai, which, as we said before, is a very dangerous area and a very dangerous part of Egypt, has been a hotbed of activity and fighting between any number of groups, Al-Qaeda at one point taking credit, but some saying the Muslim Brotherhood, which allegedly was dismantled after the coup d'etat against President Mossad. We thought the possibility of a bomb on board was a greater reality, but again, for a couple of days, there was a continued resistance, really, that this was a possibility, again indicating that ISIL did not have the sophistication. Certainly, they had the sophistication to put aboard a bomb, if you will. And so this afternoon, London time, the Prime Minister of Great Britain indicated that British air flights out of the resort city were being delayed until security preparations could be increased, enhanced, heightened, and et cetera. And then about 10 hours ago, London time, the British Prime Minister announced that the British intelligence agencies, MI5, MI6, Army Intelligence, and etc., had confirmed that ISIL was involved in the positioning, planting, however you want to phrase it, of a bomb, if you will. Apparently the bomb was in the back part of the aircraft, if you will, based on the forensic examination by any number of so-called experts. There are a large number of countries, if you will. It happened on Egyptian soil. It was a Russian aircraft, if you will. But, of course, it was made in France, and there are other countries that are very much involved. And so in the last 6 hours, as we have been monitoring it on in studio and on our monitors, the world has become very tense with regards to the possibility that ISIL has been able to place a bomb upon a Western air carrier, if you will, in this case a Russian aircraft, as we said before, a French-made Airbus. This is raising a lot of questions now within the intelligence and security community here in the United States. What does this mean? Of course, it certainly meant the loss of at least, 226 souls, human beings, if you will. Apparently, according to the manifesto, all Russian citizens, if you will. You can believe that if it is determined by the Russian security agencies and if they can identify both the group and their primary locations, that there will be significant retaliation, which will increase, unfortunately, the presence of violence in the Middle East, be it in Syria or northern Iraq, where ISIL has displayed its primary strength, though ISIL is indicating that they have moved into Libya, if you will, where there has been conflict and et cetera. And, of course, we all hear quite frequently, particularly after the senatorial hearing of presidential contender Hillary Clinton a couple of weeks ago, talking about Benghazi, if you will, which really will not go away. One has to respect in this sense that ISIL has taken on a level of sophistication. People know that they are brutal. They have shown that by the beheadings of a number of Western citizens, if you will, primarily journalists and et cetera, probably some agents or individuals identified as Western agents, be they British or French or Italian or German or whatever. But the ability to place a bomb upon a Western air carrier, as we said before, because the Russians are, quote-unquote, a part of the, quote-unquote, West, if you will, raises serious questions. It has also heightened in the last 10 hours our security at every major American airport in the, of course, not only the United States, but American carriers currently overseas getting ready to embark, if you will, come across the Atlantic, the Pacific, if you will. Some have noticed a increased security presence at many of our, as we said just seconds ago, major airports. Here in the Twin Cities, even though they will not admit it to you, and this, of course, broadcast coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the authorities will not admit that they are at a specific level. We are not sure. Of course, we know that the most extreme level is level red, if you will, which is a clear indication that there is almost a state of emergency. Of course, you can rest assured that if an American carrier, aircraft carrier, if you will, or aircraft, and the carrier being the company that the airlines is owned by, if there is a attack, if you will, if an American aircraft is blown up in the sky, we will see a level of security we have not seen since 9/11. We think it is important because this also goes to the heart of another part of our reflections tonight here on the Don and Ron program. As we said before, hopefully our co-host, Mr. Don Allen, will be joining us shortly, if you will. He is en route. But in light of the announcement by the president that he is committing and has ordered a minimal force of 50 special forces, which is really ridiculous, if you will, if you are making a commitment to put ground troops in harm's way in Syria, northern Iraq, we've already lost an American service person, if you will, in a rescue mission a week ago. But the fact of the matter is that for over a year, about a year, the United States has had a military presence in the fighting that has been going on in northern Iraq, some parts of southern Iraq, in and about Baghdad, and et cetera. But it is Syria that one needs to be concerned about. We have maintained in talking to our associates and et cetera that one of the nightmares that the Obama administration has is the potential capture of any American military personnel, advisors, or et cetera, who will probably be put on display and then beheaded by ISIL in an attempt to win more converts, if you will, to their movement, to their philosophy, if you will, to their jihad, and to the actions that they feel will enhance their continued drawing power. There has been a lot of concern expressed about the number of converts, if you will, that have not only talked about on social media and et cetera their interest and even their commitment to be engaged in the military conflicts in the Middle East, but the additional voices, those particularly in the Western, so-called more sophisticated Western countries such as England, France, if you will, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, some of the Scandinavian countries who have shown kind of a kind of a fantasy, if you will, a kind of a love affair, if one could use that word, an infatuation, maybe that's a more appropriate word, an infatuation with quote-unquote this conflict that is going on in the Middle East and maybe possibly spreading. But right now, as we talk on this program tonight, looking at some of the communiques that we see coming in, there is clearly an extreme concern amongst the Western nations. As we said before, though, it will be very interesting what the response of the Russians will be if the Russians are convinced that the information that is forthcoming, that a terrorist bomb was placed on that aircraft before it left the airport in southern Greece, in southern Egypt, if you will. We're thinking in terms of the Greeks, because it appears in some quarters that Greece assisted the British government and its intelligence agencies in regards to pinpointing where the transmissions, discussions were taking place, in which the British intelligence community, again, MI5, MI6, military intelligence, and et cetera, have become convinced that it was ISIL who were behind, quote-unquote, the destruction of a Russian aircraft. So, once again, tensions are heightened, not only in that part of the world, if you will. The Egyptians in a terrible situation because their policy has been to indicate that there is no terrorist problem inside of Egypt. Anybody that travels knows the international scene, knows that that's just not true that there is significant problems with terrorist acts, insurgency, and etc. throughout Egypt, and that the Egyptians have been having a very difficult time dealing with insurgent or terrorist forces in the Sinai, if you will. By the way, the Israelis, who are very, very conscious and very effective in security as it pertains to its airlines, are on the highest possible alert, because you would figure that Israeli aircraft, passenger aircraft, would be a very choice and very logical target for ISIL in this particular conflict, if you will. It also puts pressure on the United States to commit certainly more than 50 special forces and to commit itself to boots on the ground, which will bring a significant increase in the number of casualties of American military personnel. We repeat again that it is quite clear, and intel and information has been retrieved, intercepted, however you want to deal with it and reflect on it, that ISIL is waiting. They're, you know, they are licking their chops with regards to the first Americans that their military, particularly, that they're able to capture, and that there will be no quarter given, and that the beheading of these Americans on social media, quote-unquote, cyber, and et cetera, will be the order of the day. We repeat again what we said earlier, that ISIL's tacticians and strategists have figured that the beheading of American military personnel would increase, quote-unquote, their recruitment efforts and converts by as much as 5,000, if you will. This also comes at a time when there are serious questions about the Obama administration's declaration, if you will, that they intend to embrace as many as 200,000, ultimately over a couple-year period, of Syrians who have fled the terrible, terrible fighting. Over 250,000 people dead in that country, if you will. I can well remember 4 years ago all of the so-called white experts who were maintaining that Assad, the Syrian president, would be gone in a matter of weeks, and then it would be gone in a couple months. And that was when the casualties were at 1,400, 1,500, and 2,000, and 3,000, 4,000, 10,000. And then after it reached 10,000, for those of you that follow the international scene, you remember that the Western media stopped giving quotes. And then a number of months later, you heard the figure of 75,000 to 100,000 dead. Then you didn't hear any more for another 4 or 5 or 6 months, and then it was 200,000. And now it is over 250,000, with at least another 500,000 Syrians having fled. In fact, probably the number of Syrians that have fled their homeland is probably closer to 1 million. And it just raises the question how the assimilation will take place. With over, well, the first sortie, if you will, has been declared at the number of about 15,000 Syrians will be brought into the country over the next 6 or 7 months. The fact of the matter is, and now we kind of move towards domestic politics, the fact of the matter is this country cannot embrace that kind of continued immigration or migration, whatever reference that you intend to make or you would like to make with regards to this so-called humanitarian effort. Europe has had a mixed evaluation, if you will. Far too many of the European countries, particularly Hungary, if you will, Austria, really, if you will, certainly the so-called Balkan states, Croatia, Serbia, have clearly indicated they really don't want these brown-skinned people in their countries. Poland has not stepped up to the plate, if you will. The Scandinavian countries, who have had a long tradition of embracing those that ask for sanctuary, the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Finns, the Danish, have not fallen over indicating, you know, what specific number they will take. In fact, this crisis, this immigration crisis, if you will, this refugee crisis in Europe is actually threatening what was supposedly a strong foundation of the so-called European Union. And by the way, on that particular note, anything that threatens the European Union threatens NATO, if you will. And so we watch all of that closely, and we would ask this question on this program as an example, as a journalist and a historian, is that how will we make sure that the assimilation takes place? And talking in terms of rushing in upwards of 200,000 people who have come from war-ravished nations, regions, and et cetera, I just don't think that the receptivity that folks are saying will take place as a part of the great American humanity. It was one thing to, quote-unquote, bring in the Russians. See, no one ever talks about the Russian immigrants who flooded the United States after the collapse, so-called collapse of the Soviet Union, if you will. It is one of the issues that aggravates President Putin, who, by the way, Forbes magazine, in its edition, this month's edition, now for the third consecutive year, indicates that Vladimir Putin, president of the Russian Federated Republic, is the most powerful individual in the world, followed by, get this, Chancellor Merkel, Merkel of Germany, and then President Barack Obama has dropped from number two to number three, and then you have the Pope, if you will, and then a whole host of people after that. And so people kind of wonder how it is that this Russian person, if you will, this tyrant, as some refer to him, has positioned himself to be declared by a American publication, Forbes, as the most powerful individual on the face of the planet. So that is something that we clearly wish to watch as closely as possible. As we said before, we were expecting our associate, Mr. Don Allen, to join us in studio. I don't know if he's arrived in studio yet. Don't see him, but we will continue to move on. We find it imperative that we take a look at our own situation here in the Twin Cities. We have had a number of reflections, and on last week's program, which we did, if you will, we raised some questions about the information and the reports and the studies that have come out with regards to the collapse of the African-American economic base here in the Twin Cities and throughout the state of Minnesota, technically, though certainly the largest portion, if you will, of the African-American population is here in the Twin Cities. For those in our domestic and international audience, a couple months ago, the U.S. Bureau of Census, or the U.S. Census Bureau, came out with a shocking and devastating report, and that report indicated that the African-American community, I mean, we are only, as it pertains to median income, we're only in the mid-20,000, if you will, so it wasn't like this week we're enjoying real middle classism. But the Bureau of Census, who is commissioned and obligated to gather this kind of information, pointed out that the black community in the state of Minnesota had lost 15% of our quote unquote economic earning power and economic base. I mean, that's a nice chunk of money. You know, when you're only at initially about $26,000. Average median income for African Americans, the sons and daughters of the African American, in one of the most prosperous states in this country, if you will. And you kind of just lose $4,000 of that earning. You know, you kind of maybe drop down to $22,000. Now, that was for 2014, and our continued examination as a journalist and historian, et cetera, is that we have lost an additional 2,500 to possibly 3,000. You know, what that does for the African American here in the state of Minnesota is means that the median income for African Americans is probably closer to 19,500, which almost puts us below certain third world nations, if you will. And that is frightening. For those that are involved in, quote unquote, the upkeep of the African American community, I know that many of you have seen the increased numbers as it pertains to the level of poverty, quality housing, or the lack of for African Americans, if you will. Last week's program, we talked quite a bit about the misinformation that we felt that a man by the name of Alex Tittle had provided on a program on a urban contemporary radio station here in the Twin Cities. We thought that his numbers were totally inconsistent for those that we indicated that we would respond to any questions, if you will. Our data clearly shows that, and this data is information taken from quote-unquote reports and the filing of reports by the facilities, the Sports Facilities Authority, who are the second tier of reporting and monitoring what is happening on, they keep talking about the People's Stadium, but the U.S. Bank bought that name, and it is now the U.S. Bank facility, if you will. But the reason that that also becomes important is that a lot of money has been paid to the Sports Facility Authority and actually back to the state of Minnesota. And, of course, the contractual agreement indicates that there shall be a certain percentage that goes to the Minnesota Vikings, who will be the prime tenant of the People's Stadium when it is allegedly completed on July 1, 2016. I think I heard, think I saw my colleague, Mr. Allen.
Yes, absolutely.
We've kind of been talking a little bit. Though we may get a call from our aviation consultant, Don. Want to put you on notice if you see that number coming out of, you know, the location. We may get a. We've talked, left a message for our aviation consultant about 45 minutes ago. We know that they are in consultation with other consultants around the country as they are all trying to put together the information on the statement by the British Prime Minister earlier today that the Russian aircraft that was lost over the Sinai was the victim of a terrorist bomb. But if you would, on the big console there in your studio, keep an eye on it. But right now we're taking a look at the information about good times, good days for the African-American population, and as we program, the numbers just don't match up. We were doing
not at all.
Well, as some of, quote-unquote, our leaders are, have been saying for the last number of months, there's no way in the world that the economic base, if you will, the African-American community could fall by 15%. I mean, just the fact that over almost $3 million in salaries have allegedly been paid on the Viking Stadium, unquote, as part of the 37%, that in itself would stem the tide, you would think, of a 15% collapse, right? But no one has produced any information, any documentation. I will say this, and then I will turn to my colleague, Mr. Allen. In the next two editions of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the largest and oldest African-American newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, we are doing a two-part series based on documentation and based on, since 2012, Don, as I talked to you about in the production meeting, 46 articles that I have written about, quote-unquote, the guaranteed failure I repeat that again, the guaranteed failure of African-American participation, particularly in the construction of the largest public works project in the history of the state of Minnesota, the now $1.4 billion U.S. Bank / Viking Stadium. But welcome, Mr. Allen, and what else, and what do you have? And let's keep it rolling. We've got another basic half hour, correct? We're going to 9:30.
Yes, we do.
The phone lines. Let's do this. There may be some people that maybe had wanted to call in. Let's just shoot the number out there because the phone lines are open, if you will. I've had
some calls
from around the country, and we welcome them to call in and join us. Please give that number out.
Sure. That number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Our phone lines, like Mr. Edwards said, are wide open, and we would love to hear from you.
Mr. Allen, I understand that there's been some concern, once again, about the Ron Don team. An article in my paper, the Spokesman Recorder, in which there was supposedly an explanation on what happened to the $3 million that was set aside, allocated for the Black People's Black History Museum. What is the latest on that? Any update for us in this hour's program?
Well, you know, Mr. Edwards, we have a really difficult time trying to decipher, as you know, and as our listeners know, me and Mr. Edwards and I were always on this museum thing because there's some lying going on, and we just have to put it in straight. Now, this is from a copyrighted article, the Spokesman Recorder, authored by my co-host, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. This is the money. This is how it looks. And then I'm going to go back to this article, this flimsy article that I read. So the museum took a $1.2 million loan from Franklin National Bank. That's one. Get your calculators out. A $1 million from the state of Minnesota. Add that up. That's $2.2 million. $1.5 million in bonds from the city of Minneapolis. $3.7 million. Another $500,000. Now we up near $4 million. And from 500,000 from five Minnesota corporations, and another $300,000 from other sources. Okay, we're shooting close to $5 million right there that can be documented. And Mr. Edwards, I had to go back and refer to your article because, you know, I hate recreating the wheel, but you wrote something very profound there. You said,
Could you give us the date so that we don't have to spend our time authenticating?
You know what? I'm going to have to go back and Google it because all I did was copy and paste it, and I didn't even go back to it. And my bad, but I will go back to it. It's an article you wrote, and I'll get back to it. But if you want to find it, Google Black History Museum, Minneapolis, Ron Edwards, Spokesman Recorder, and it will pop right up. But you wrote in that article, we need to stop being silent about the troubling number of Black leaders who have defaulted or who are in the process of defaulting on loans and obligations to Franklin National Bank due to their sharing loans with friends and family, taking away from their stated mission. The shoe is now on the other foot. Now, to the article written, Mr. You're like one of them soothsayers, Mr. Edwards, that you just see things into the future and you write it, and when it comes to fruition, we can look at it again.
Yes,
so
sir.
So the article in the Spokesman Recorder, one of my favorite papers, I must say, the reporter quoted officials from the museum saying that it was institutionalized racism. That's why the museum didn't open. But you wrote, people now see how dangerous it is to play with the race card when allegations and contentions are not supported by the facts. Bam. We must accept that not everyone is a good manager of financial responsibility and accountability. Losing focus and failing to improve on a church or expand another Black nonprofit or in an attempt to save a longtime youth agency has diverted funds, sabotaged stated dreams and vision. So that right there, Mr. Edwards, is in a nutshell. Now, we're not slandering, we're not defaming anybody. I haven't mentioned who the board chair was or at the time, or who the executive director, because they're public people. I can say their names, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt because I'm not trying to give them no pub at all from this show. because we don't get none on theirs when they do their little $5,000 speaking fees and that kind of nonsense.
Uh-huh.
But here you have close to $5 million documented, and the Somali community opened a museum with less than $50,000.
Yeah, the difference between $5 million and $50,000, right? Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, while I drink some of my diet ginger ale, clear my throat, we have a problem where I would just like to shout out to those people in the museum. You know, I think everyone is kind of strange until I really get to know them, and I knew y'all were strange all along, the whole time, but if we could just get, what I would rather see is what they do in corporate America. You know, because you have failures. Failures help you build character. But you haven't come to the forefront and says, okay, we screwed up. Our financial management was off. We misused some funds that we shouldn't have used. We made some bad decisions. But we still need an African-American museum. Rather than the flip side of what they're doing, they're not answering questions. No comment. You know, there are institutionalized racism. It's the white man that didn't let us open the museum. Well, the white man put almost $5 million in the bank account.
And let me say this for our listening audience, particularly our domestic and international audience. In a copyrighted story in the Spokesman Recorder, an interview with the board chair, who is also the president of the Minneapolis NAACP and is also the head of Black Lives Matter Minneapolis, because there are two Black Lives Matter chapters in St. Paul. She indicated that all they need right now was for a payout of and be able to raise $1.3 million, which would take it up to almost $6.5
million. Oh, yeah.
That's all that they need, just $1.3 million. And they can open, and this is an interesting statement in the article, that they could open at the current site. Now, I don't know where the current site's at. It's certainly not at the facility that they first called home, which is just behind the Minneapolis Convention Center there on the so-called near south side. So it couldn't be there. We first reported exclusively here on the Don and Ron program that their leadership about 6 months ago were telling people that they were getting ready to buy a piece of property just over the city line in St. Paul, just about four blocks down the street from KSTP, for those who, you know, want to know their geography. So now we're being told that all they need is to raise $1.3 million, pay back the debt as an outgrowth of the facility in downtown, on the edge of downtown Minneapolis, being auctioned. Oh, that's right, Don. It was auctioned off. I mean, auction
was,
is kind of different than making a sale. You know, auction is a forced process, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so now they're looking for an additional $1.3 million. And they need to raise that in 6 months, and then they say that they can get things started again get the museum moving. Now, you made an interesting reflection on documentation, and by the way, the article that you made reference to out of the Spokesman Recorder under my byline was 2013. So, you know, we were kind of way out in front once again. But they still owe Franklin Bank all that money. And then, by the way, the former City Inc. Youth Corporation still owes $600,000 to Franklin National Bank. We have other organizations and churches that owe money to Franklin National Bank and et cetera. You know, we've kind of encumbered a lot of debt, but I mean, I understand, because I saw in the article and I've heard people talk that, you know, we have to experience quote unquote failure. Now, I have to tell you, Mr. Allen, I've lived in Minnesota since 1945. Okay. And I'm a 76-year-old African American, so that we don't have to play the age game. So I've been here since 1945. I have seen a lot of endeavors, if you will. I've seen a lot of African Americans step forward, if you will, with ventures, business ventures, and et cetera. And I've seen many of them that were successful. I've seen some that were not. Now, a significant number of black businesses were relocated or displaced because of urban renewal and et cetera, and that would be back in 1952, 53, 54. And certainly there are historical chronicles, if you will, that talk about that. But in the last 15 years, as a young man by the name of Booker Hodges, former president of the Minneapolis NAACP, and a young man who wrote an article talking in terms of over $10 million back in the mid-1990s that were given to black organizations and et cetera, we're not even talking about what happened after 2000 and after 2001 as an example. So, you know, we're talking over $20 million easily just in monies that were provided to, quote-unquote, black dreams and black ambitions. And then, you know, that all turns out to be black failure. And then everybody tries to redesign and recreate history, right? And so I'm just trying to make sure that we're absolutely clear historically about what it is that we're talking about, you know, because some people have just kind of arrived in the state here in the last decade or et cetera, and they kind of make it appear that it was their arrival here that began, quote-unquote, the history of the African-American. I mean, black people, black Americans, were in this state when it was and before it was a territory. So we're talking 1830, 1840, 1820. I mean, I know how difficult that could be for some people, if you will, understanding that there was that history and et cetera. So I just want to, you know, back the play, if you will, by my colleague that, you know, we ask these questions within a spirit, if you will, of historical reference. And so it's not like that black people did not have successful ventures in this state going as far back as the 1920s and the 1930s, Mr. Allen. So I just felt it imperative as an older African-American to kind of do that for us. But go ahead, sir. And again, the phone lines are open.
Phone lines are wide open, yes. And we do have callers standing by. But, Mr. Harris, I just want to get this in because, you know, like you said, these people, they come here and they act like they're the saviors of Minnesota. But if you notice, no native-born Minnesotans are really running anything, especially any African-American Minnesotan born and raised here running anything. You got the DFL, Ken Martin from Florida, Congressman Keith Ellison, Detroit. Who else we got here that shouldn't be here? I mean, I shouldn't say that shouldn't be here, but you have a lot of people here in key positions running nonprofits and just doing things, and they look and they figured out, well, hey, these Minnesota black people is kind of slow. Let's get in where we can fit in. Let's get in where we can fit in, and let's go ahead and we're going to take this over here, and y'all take this part. And so we'll get this. The nonprofit sector is not like the private sector, as we well know. I don't mean to insult anybody's intelligence, but what happens is they have their hands out. There is no expiration date on a nonprofit, and there should be, because we sat up here, and I'm guilty as anybody else, but I've been vocal about it. So if you, Mr. Edwards, well, generally the black community, the same black community that let Teron Cruz lose the first ward in St. Paul yesterday by a landslide, is the same community who sat here and watched almost $5 million get poured down the drain and the buildings sold to the people they own money to. And now they talk they want more. They can't afford the real estate by KSTP or the light rail. You know?
Absolutely.
So
Don, let's get that caller. We don't want it. We've got someone that's taking the time to call. Let's get the caller in,
okay.
Find out what they want.
We're going
to be going until 9:30 unless we feel that things picked up, and we will ask for a couple more increased minutes.
Yep.
But go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
I'm on the air.
Yes, you are.
Oh, Brother M, good to hear you, man. Are you here back in the United States, or are you
calling
us from South Africa?
No, I'm here back in the United States. I had technical difficulties. I tried to call you from South Africa.
Yes, we recognized that, and we made people understand it was probably the NSA tampering with the transmission. But go ahead. What can we do for it? What's your observation?
Well, just a couple things. I'd like to just springboard a little bit on your, you know, your expose on the museum, which, as you gentlemen know, I feel is a very sad, sad situation. And I think now that it's been uncovered, I did happen to see, I guess, the current identified herself as an executive of the what seems to be a defunct facility. She identified herself and that made a plea, passionate plea for additional funds, you know, and that they were well poised, as Mr. Allen said, to purchase land somewhere in St. Paul, IKSTP, and reopen. And just as if nothing happened before, it was just as if nothing. If you just give us this money, we'll show you what we can do, and we'll have a museum. But you know, the million-dollar question remains: what happened to the money? I mean, that's a million-dollar question. And unfortunately, these things, for some reason—I mean, it shouldn't—but for some reason, these things seem to take like unballing a ball of yarn. They seem to take a long time to unravel before these things come to fruition. So what happens is you miss all this time, you miss all this momentum, you miss all this interest with people doing a museum while you're, you know, spending time to get to the bottom of something that's quite apparent. Money was given and it's gone. Well, let's get to the bottom of it. But I don't see any effort or any zeal from anyone except, you know, the Ron and Don show to hold anyone accountable.
I mean, isn't that sad? Yeah.
It is.
Let me
it's
just say that
sad.
On this particular point also, because we have been also talking about the minutes of the last couple of NAACP meetings. In fact, they met last night, the NAACP Minneapolis branch. And, of course, a couple of days ago, the president of the St. Paul branch was on, and he was waxing and et cetera. He was somewhat, I think, critical. I think he was kind of talking about us, Don, when he said those people who never have anything positive to say and et cetera. I thought the truth was positive. My teaching, angelic teaching, tells me that the advancement and the promotion of the truth, that's positive. It may hurt, but it's positive. But I've heard these discussions going on about the fact that, you know, we shouldn't really be talking about these kinds of things, that everything is really in great shape. Then I take a look at City Inc., the $600,000 that was never paid back, that caused that facility to close down and caused a significant group of African-American students to have nowhere to go that particular year. We reported that on this program, on the Don and Ron Hour, if you will. And what you're saying, Em, is that this peculiar pattern just continues and continues and continues. In the meanwhile, you know, you get a government report. You know, now, they didn't jump on the Bureau of Census, Mr. Allen, and accuse them of being negative and et cetera. You know, I don't know if that's kind of plantation mentality of not challenging or making the boss angry. But think about that, gentlemen, both of you. No criticism whatsoever. In fact, it necessitated the governor running out and creating a single one-person office entitled the Office of Minority Economic Development. And I don't know, gentlemen, what that means. M or Mr. Allen, maybe you can help me. What does that office mean?
That office is a DFL ploy. So they can start sending phone calls somewhere because the governor's staff is sick of fielding these calls about what's happening with the black community. So this person's going to be like a high-rated secretary with no power.
Oh, a referral agency then, a kind of office of referral. Office of Minority Referral. Okay, just if you have a question about the Negro problem, let us find a place to refer it to.
What we used to call the circular file. I mean, I think.
Oh, Lord, have mercy. It sounds almost like CIA, the circular file.
Yes. I mean, we're you know, coming from, you know, my trip to South Africa, which was a very enlightening, I tell you. You know, I mean, when you see how 10% can control 90%, I mean, you can't. I mean, my calculator blew up trying to figure out how that works.
Yeah.
And so you see that, you know, all these things that have been just set up is for one particular purpose. And that's the superiority of you know who.
Yes.
And
okay.
and you see it so blatantly, you know, when you're in the continent where, I mean, clearly there's 90%. And, you know, I met a lot of brothers and sisters in Cape Town and in South Africa. Cape Town, by the way, reminds you of San Francisco. It's a beautiful
city.
Yes,
it does, doesn't it? There you go. Right.
Beautiful
place. Right,
right on the ocean. Right on the
yes.
ocean. Right on that. You can see why they wanted
the mountain
to
right behind the city itself.
Oh,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, that mountain
yeah.
and Cape Town reminds
Table
me
mountain,
of
one
Rio
Table
de
Mountain, Table Mountain, one of the seven, you know, wonders of the world.
Yes, yes. It reminds
then,
me of Rio de Janeiro. It's
yeah,
interesting.
It's,
yes,
it's beautiful.
Yes.
But you know the system, you know, the citizens there, you know, the African American citizens there. There's a clear hierarchy still. You know, realize it's 21 years past apartheid. So there, I mean, I basically felt like I was in the 40s or 50s here. Okay.
Right.
I mean, that's basically what there it is there. You know, jobs are scarce. I mean, they're advertising on the television, you know, careers, like we'll see things where you go to career. Well, there's a big career is to be a concierge, okay?
Right.
If you can raise to that level, you've really, you know, if you're African American, that's kind of what's held out as a high esteem. You know, that's, you know, higher than the dishwasher, higher than the mopper, higher than the. Yeah, but what really got me is an area called District 6. I don't know if you've historically, you know, which was an area in South Africa where the Africans had established a real strong city. You know, it really kind of reminds me of the Oklahoma situation
Oklahoma.
Here in this country. Tulsa, Oklahoma
yes.
in the 20s.
Tulsa, Oklahoma, yes.
Yeah. In
Black Wall Street.
Like
yes.
Wall Street. And District
yes.
6 was a similar type of a thing with nightclubs and music and an integrated type of scene that was a worldwide base.
Uh-huh.
And then someone decided, well, no, we don't want that. We don't want that. And what they did is they bulldozed it.
Right.
They bulldozed. They raised their community and just sent them to the hills.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And back to the
shanty towns, right?
Back mm-hmm. to the shanty. Well, that's where they. Yeah, back to the shanties, mm-hmm. which are just makeshift situations, lean-tos with, you know, anything that's shelter.
Open trenches for sanitary purposes and etc.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I repeat that again for our sophisticated Western listeners and in our own beloved America, open trenches. In other words, if you had to relieve yourself in the evening, you know, you woke up in the middle of the night, you just go out, you find one of those trenches, and you just, you know, you urinate, you pass your bowels, and et cetera, and it's
mm-hmm.
just an open
mm-hmm.
trench.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you know, what really struck me, gentlemen, was the saddest thing about that is, you know, they were functioning quite fine, you know, interracially integrated, but nobody gave a second thought to it.
Mm-hmm.
Until at some point someone said, well, no, we can make more money. We need to just take the whole thing over.
Yes.
So what it is, it just struck me as it's not a natural thing to hate one another. It's a thing where now it's so ingrained. It's so that you, when you're born, there's already a set of things in place.
Mm-hmm.
That the first thing you do when you see TV or read a paper or when you read, it's bias, okay?
Uh-huh.
From the moment that you're born, these things continue to, you know, they've set a system where, they, you know, the deception has been practiced to a point where, you know, it permeates. And,
right. And let me say this also.
Yeah.
Some are saying that the ANC has grown tired, and some even say they've grown both tired and corrupt. And I'm so sorry to hear that, based on the legacy of Nelson Mandela, one of the greatest human beings ever to walk this planet. And yet, with with his death and et cetera, you know, his teachings and strength have apparently not carried over like they're supposed to, like they should have, and that is really unfortunate.
No one's picked up that torch, and you know he paid such a price to do that too. You know, he paid.
Oh yes. Again, for our younger listening audience, Nelson Mandela, 25 years on Robben's Island.
Yeah,
25 years.
25 years on Robben's Island,
yes,
and you know,
yes.
and it's a very cruel. You know, Robben's Island is, like I say, this reminds me of San Francisco, because you look out into the sea and you can see Robben's Island, just like you can see Alcatraz.
Yes.
You know, just like you can see that.
Yes,
it's the same.
Right.
It looks exactly like, just like you can see Alcatraz. So, it's the cruelest thing to, you know, to sequester you there, and you can see what freedom is. You can see it. But you can't get to it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a cruel 25 years that that man withstood. And I had a chance to go to it, but, you know, I decided to not go because it was a blustery day. And I've pretty much seen how cruel man can be to another man. I've seen slavery, the Holocaust. I've seen the cruelty. I didn't run it. I've been to Alcatraz, and I think, you know, you've seen one, you know.
You've kind of seen them all. Yeah.
I've seen them all. But, it was a very enlightening trip, and, I would suggest to people, if they can ever get a chance to go over there, it'll open your mind to a lot of things.
Yes, I have a good friend of mine. I remember she and a delegation, including at that time District Court Judge LeJune Lang and et cetera. She was a former school board member, name of Carol Ann White, who has since relocated and moved back to her native home of Kansas City. And I remember she and Judge Lang and a couple others holding like seminars and et cetera upon their return about South Africa. The process hadn't really totally started that you shared with us, if you will. And, of course, Nelson Mandela was still the president, and they were on what seemed to be a great path. And I remember a lot of reflections about the truth and reconciliation tribunals and et cetera. I'd like to invite you to join us maybe a little bit earlier, next week, and kind of walk us through and entertain some Q&A as it pertains to what you saw. That's just a rich experience which needs to be shared, particularly with our younger people, because you said something rather interesting, how easy it's become to embrace and instill the self-hatred and et cetera. And, man, that's what we are seeing. Correct, Mr. Allen? That's what we're seeing on the streets of our own beloved Twin Cities, if you will. So I'd like to ask you, we're down to really the last minute, if you join us a little bit earlier next
I'll do that.
Wednesday, if you're able
that.
To, M.
I'll do that. I'd love to share
like to really
some
get
of
into
it.
Some details.
I'd love to
All
share
right.
some of it to your listeners.
All right. Thank you,
All
sir,
right.
for taking the time and calling in.
All right.
Okay.
Yep.
Yes, Mr. Allen. Okay, we're down to 90 seconds. Mr. Allen, anything you want to share? And if not, I guess we take us on home. Interesting program tonight.
Yeah. We'll be back next week. Tune in at 8:30 to Ron and Don Show. The phone lines will be open next week, so call in early.
Brother, we can't quit. Until we get our share.